It's the Marketplace Tech Podcast for Wednesday the 17th. I'm Ben Johnson in New York. A case that could have cost Apple as much as $1 billion for a software update has been rejected by a jury this week. The question, whether or not Apple's iTunes 7 update way back in 2006 undermined the ability of people to listen to music from non-iTunes sources on their iPods and other devices. Apple apparently won by comparing listening to music on iPods to, for instance, playing a proprietary Nintendo game on a Nintendo console. Tech companies say they use this kind of so-called digital rights management to fight illegal piracy. To talk with us more about this is our friend and New York Times technology columnist Molly Wood. Molly, how are you?
I'm well, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, although I have many times said that the update is the devil. And though this case may not have proven it, it does seem like at least some small bit of proof that the update can be bedeviling.
In this case, it sounded like there was a possibility that Apple was using updates of its iTunes software to update really the technology that it used to lock down songs so that
right.
you couldn't transfer them to other devices.
And why does it seem like this case has now fallen apart?
It seems to have fallen apart partly because the plaintiffs couldn't come up with anyone who said, I lost a song. And so on one level, the decision by the jury makes sense. On the other hand, the ruling seems to, in some ways, validate lock-in as a business plan.
Which we're all now sort of like accustomed to, but we should still, by some arguments, be mad about.
I want to believe that we should be still fighting the good fight against digital rights management that prevents us from doing things that we can do in the physical world. And I think people don't always realize how bad things are. You know, recently, Amazon, for example, rolled out the ability for you to share a book with up to 5 members of your family.
Which you could do forever to 80 members of your family with an actual book.
Right. So this iPod case, you know, maybe no one was harmed and they couldn't play a song that they ripped from a CD, but it was certainly difficult for them to incorporate those libraries. And it is still difficult to share music between 2 iTunes accounts, even if you are married. And that those difficulties still exist, but I think the modern digital consumer has gotten used to paying over and over and over for the same media.
These kids don't know how good it used to be.
They have no idea, and they're comfortable in ecosystems.
Yeah.
And they don't switch often enough to feel the pain.
Our friend and New York Times technology columnist Molly Wood. Molly, thank you.
My pleasure.
Marketplace has been on the air for 25 years, and that couldn't have happened without the support from listeners like you. So please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today and help us keep our coverage relevant and compelling. And you should know that your gift in any amount counts twice, thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st and help us reach our goal of at least 2,500 donors. Thanks for your support. Today, something very important turns 25 years old. Here's a hint. Almost hard to believe The Simpsons have been going this long, but here's why I'm talking to you about it. The TV show, one of the longest running in the history of television, actually innovated a special kind of joke. And it happens right there. That's when, in The Simpsons opening credits, baby Maggie Simpson gets scanned in the grocery store checkout line. Her price? In the intro that launched in 1989, it was $847.63, which was supposedly the average monthly cost of having a child during that time. If you blinked, you'd miss it. There are tons of these little references and jokes in the show, and they've got a name. Pause jokes or freeze frame jokes. People would tape episodes, then go back and hit pause to get them. Proof that VCRs, DVD players, and even DVRs and streaming have actually changed the culture of television. So on The Simpsons' birthday, let's talk to a writer and former showrunner for The Simpsons, Bill Oakley. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Who comes up with freeze frame jokes on the show? Does it happen in the writer's room or what?
Usually the person who's writing the first draft takes a crack at it. And in many cases, their jokes need a little improvement, so the group of writers in the room perfects them.
They happen really fast, right? So in most cases, you actually need to hit pause in order to see the joke and get the joke, right? Like in the opening sequence when Bart is writing on the chalkboard?
The chalkboard, I think people could probably read, but many of the jokes are ones like the sign on the church, like no synagogue parking or private wedding, please worship elsewhere, that you couldn't possibly have time to read without pausing.
As a writer, how did you think about that? I mean, did you know your audience would actually be using VCRs to tape episodes? How did this idea sort of come about?
I think, as is typical with Simpsons, everything becomes as hard as it can possibly be. You could never just have a store that was called, like, Butcher Shop. It would have to be a hilarious joke that, like, or an itchy and scratchy title that was really simple. And a lot of times those took more time than pitching regular jokes, lines for Homer and Bart. Like, coming up with those itchy and scratchy titles was the worst. And the freeze frame jokes were often the same way, because they have to be a certain type of joke.
Do you think writers now think a lot more about the technology that's being used to watch the show as they're creating the show?
I think The Simpsons was ahead of its time in that regard. I mean, The Simpsons was the only show doing anything like that in the 1990s. Most live action shows don't really want to spend a lot of time having a prop master create a sign with a funny joke on it if you're not going to be able to read it.
I want to talk about two episodes you co-wrote with Josh Weinstein, who shot Mr. Burns Part 1 and 2. In them, Lisa's trying to figure out who tried to kill Mr. Burns. How did you use freeze frame technology to leave clues throughout the two episodes?
We were well aware that most, like, hardcore viewers of the show were taping the show on VHS tapes and pausing to read all the little signs and stuff. So we figured this is a great place to cram in the clues. And it was not possible to put the mystery together without using freeze frame.
Is there a part of you guys that's you're just coming up with these things just to make yourselves laugh?
In that case, we were like, yes, let's make this the ultimate reward for being a hardcore fan, that you can solve the mystery at home.
Right.
In other cases, given our druthers, we'd probably rather go home than make up a joke for the sign at the butcher shop. But but we know that that's what people expect from The Simpsons, and we make it as fun as possible.
Bill Oakley worked as a writer and then a showrunner for The Simpsons. Bill, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for calling.
All right, I've posted an example of one of my favorite pause jokes from the show Arrested Development. Go check it out and post your own. Facebook.com/MarketplaceTech. I'm Ben Johnson, and that's our show today. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.